This morning, we're studying something. It kind of goes along with the Bible study just a little bit, there where we were studying Acts chapter 15. But Abraham and his righteousness. Now, that's a lot is said about that in the passages that Brother Brad read for us just a few moments ago. And it is something that's important. Well, verse 3, you can see there that it says here, and it depends on your translation, it will say, Abraham believed God, and it was credited or accounted or reckoned or imputed. Have one of those words in there. It varies, and there is that much variation in it. And there's a reason for that. Many of our religious friends and neighbors, and perhaps we have some in-the-flesh relatives, they hold to the view of once saved, always saved, or the impossibility of apostasy. And I know there's sometimes we ask ourselves, how does that come about? And I think another question is there a mechanism for such a doctrine? In other words, is there a system or something that they use to come up with this? And the answer is found, I think, largely, in Romans chapter 4. They like to go there, they like to camp there, talk about Abraham and his righteousness. And there's a word that's found in association with it. And it was in the translation that Brother Brad was using there. It's the word impute. I've got to admit, that's not an everyday word for a lot of us. And that word being there, not just in the King James and New King James today, but it was in older translations going all the way back to Tyndale. So there would have been many who would have been aware of this. And what's happened over the years is that's been given almost a mythical and a different spin than what it actually means. But we're going to study this and see if we can understand the mechanism and see what the truth is on this. So the very first thing that we need to do is look at some terms and the theology behind it. First of all, there's righteousness. Now, Mr. Thayer says that righteousness, in a broad sense, it's the state of him who is as he ought to be. Righteousness, the condition acceptable to God. Now, I've added to this, it means it's doing things right, properly, appropriately, according to God. And actually the word righteous comes from an old English word, right wise, W-I-S-E. And so you can see how right wise jammed together, slurred a little bit of a different spin put on the word as English was transitioning. And right wise became righteous. And so it means those kinds of things, doing something right and properly. But now in the scriptures, it's according to God, as God would have it. Then there's the other word in there, that it was accounted, credited, or whatever, however your translation reads. I've got accounted there on the screen. You'll see how this works here in a moment or two. But this comes from a Greek word, logizomai. Now, Thayer says that the word, in the original language, means to reckon, count, compute, calculate, count over, to take into account, to make an account of, metaphorically, to pass to one's account, and finally to impute. And actually, my understanding of this is that it is an accounting term. Something that someone, you know, that's keeping books, bookkeeping. They'd use that kind of a word. They put things down in a column. This is to your credit. This is to your debit. And things like that. That's how. And then, but it's used over. I think it's used the same way in the scriptures. Don't get me wrong, but it's translated so many different ways. This one right here is what excites everybody, and where they find room for some kind of the mechanism for once saved, always saved, and so on. Maybe, I don't have it up there, but I know the New American Standard Bible has credit.
And that might be a good word too. That might be perhaps the best of all possibilities. But now here's what happens. Some come over here and they found this word here. And they're looking for something to fit their doctrine, which is, again, the impossibility of apostasy, once saved, always saved. And behind all of that is total hereditary depravity. That's what starts everything. Then you move on from that, and then finally when a person is said to be saved, then there comes in here all the other things as a result of this. So impugned is really the linchpin of the whole doctrine, that, and how they use that and what they say that this particular word means. They've determined in their theology that impute means transfer. Well, I would disagree with that. That's not what it means. Now, in the reading there just a moment ago, if you look at verse 8. Let me get this out here. Romans chapter 4, verse 8. Now, let me read this. I got the New King James here. It says in verse 8, "Blessed is the man to whom the Lord shall not impute sin." Well, they take that word to mean if the man is blessed that will not impute sin, that means the Lord can impute sin. And what does that mean? Well, remember now, in their theology, that means transfer. So what would be transferred in verse 8? Original sin. The sin of Adam. That's transferred, for example, to you and me. That's what that means. And that's how they use it. And then on the other hand, when you get up here to verse 6, as David also describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. What righteousness are they talking about here that's imputed or transferred? Well, it's the righteousness of Christ is imputed to one who believes. The righteousness of Christ is transferred to the believer. I've always thought this whole idea, you're trying to think of it in terms that, you know, you can picture. When they talk about once saved, always saved, or the impossibility of apostasy, they look at this as being some like a shield that goes over everybody, like a plastic bubble that appears over everybody. And sin can't penetrate this. And the plastic bubble that they think, well, they think that's the righteousness of Christ that's transferred to you, and that's how you're kept safe and everything else. And I've got to admit, that's something that's attractive. I'd like to think that there was such a thing that would be working and everything along that line. And I think that there are a number of brethren that believe that. But here's the thing. I know that there's all of these Calvinists that believe it. I'd say in the world, there are easily millions of people that believe this. Now you might think to yourself, oh no, nobody that's a member of the church believes this. Well, don't get too hasty thinking that, because there's a lot that do. We do it a little different way, but we end up the same way. We end up with, well, you know what? I'm not really responsible for what I do. The righteousness of Christ has been transferred to me. And he's out there taking all of it while I'm over here essentially doing nothing. And little is expected out of me, because not only has Jesus done everything for me, he's now doing everything for me. And so little is expected of me because of Jesus. And that's how this kind of thing works. And actually I think it's kind of an invitation to perhaps a lower level of living. But this, again, is all part and parcel of the doctrine of Calvinism. It fits in with total inherited depravity. That's what's transferred to the believer. And the perseverance of the saints, That's the one saved, always saved, which follows after the other. You got to have that. You got to have the one for the other as a solution. But now here's the thing. And I looked them all up. And I looked them up in like 6 or 7 different translations. I wasn't going to spend a whole lot of time on it. That was plenty of time to spend. But no more than that. I could not find one translation of the New Testament that had the word logizomai translated as transfer. It's just, it's not there. If that is obviously what this means, if that's what impute means, then why don't you find the word transfer there someplace? No matter how far the translation may be out into the left field, you think you'd find one. But you can't find this. And so, you know, I think to myself, well, the reason maybe that you can't find it is because they know that's not what this means. Now, every once in a while, there's somebody who comes along and they'll surprise you to find out, well, now they're a Calvinist. I've got a friend whose parents are hard shell Calvinists. And yet they do not believe in the 5 points of Calvinistic doctrine. And I'm just surprised at that. I'm surprised that even a hardshell Calvinist, but that's what he says. And I thought, well, that's extremely rare. But now, we've probably all heard of a man by the name of Albert Barnes. And Albert Barnes compiled a set of commentaries. The New Testament commentaries are all his. Some of the Old Testament commentaries are his. Some of the others are works of other men. But we've all heard of Barnes' notes, I think. I think there's a copy downstairs in the bookcase down there. I have a copy at home. They're available online. They've been around a long time. Because Albert Barnes lived back in the late 18th century and some into the 19th century. Now, he was a Calvinistic commentator. And on this very point, he was tried for heresy by the Presbyterian Church that he was a member of. And here's the reason why he was tried for heresy, because he put this idea throughout his notes, same thing, he said it every time. And when he was called upon to retract this or repudiate it, he refused to do so. So he was called on trial for heresy. And he wasn't convicted, but he had, as you could probably well understand, he had a mark placed next to him, and he was suspect from then on. Now, he was an incredibly brilliant man. He's right on a whole number of things. I think he was right on this. He disagreed with his brethren, and he would disagree with a lot of folks today. He noted in the commentary on Romans, I've examined all the passages, and as a result of my examination, I've come to the conclusion that there is not one in which the word is used in the sense of reckoning or imputing to a man what does not strictly belong to him, or of charging on him what ought not to be charged on him as a matter of personal right. The word is never used to denote imputing in the sense of, watch this now, transferring, or of charging that on one which does not properly belong to him. No doctrine of transferring or of setting over to a man what does not properly belong to him, be it sin or holiness, can be derived, therefore, from this word. In other words, he disagreed that the sins of all mankind and Adam are transferred to a person, and he did not believe that if that person were to believe that the righteousness of Christ was transferred to him. He didn't believe in that transferring business. Either way. And I've always thought to myself, well, I think he had it right. What happened was, he didn't own the copyright to all of his notes. And later on, somebody, they printed his notes, and then they had another point of view in those notes. It made it all confusing when you look at his commentary on Romans. But anyway, Now, let's just have a look at the scriptures now. I think the answer's real easy here. We ask the question, well, what was accounted to Abraham? What was accounted? What was credited? What was imputed to Abraham? Because that's what it says here. I mean, there's just no question about that.
When you look at Romans chapter 4 and verse 3, you see that Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Now, the New King James has that Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness.
Now, on the point of clarification, there's nothing here in this passage that says there was something that was transferred to Abraham. But it does say that something of Abraham's was accounted to him.
Now look at what it says there. It says there, and most translations have it this way. It was credited, it was accounted to him for right. What was accounted? There's an it there. Well, what is it that's accounted here? Now, some folks, you know, well, we'll just throw anything in there. We'll throw in the sin of Adam. Or we'll throw in there, you know, that's where how sin comes about, and we'll transfer. Or we'll throw in this case, since it was for righteousness, we'll throw in where the righteousness of Christ was credited to him for righteousness. That's the it. Now, I learned a long time ago, and this is true in almost any language, whenever there's an indefinite pronoun, like it, anytime there's anything indefinite, you start looking for an antecedent. In other words, there's something that comes before this that the it refers to. If you say something like the battery, you know, it died. Battery in the car, it died. What's the it? It's the battery. You go back to the antecedent to find it. So let's just try that here. When it says it was credited or accounted to him as righteousness, what is that? You suppose it's got anything to do with Abraham believed God? Now keep in mind this is an accounting term. So something was put down to Abraham's credit. No, it wasn't. I don't think you, unless you just want to go through a whole bunch of mumbo jumbo and hocus pocus and make a word into what it's never intended to be, you're going to look at this and you're going to say, I think it's Abraham's faith. That was accredited to him for righteousness. That's where you'd come out. And I think that would be right. It's not transferring or anything. Something's of his was accounted or credited to him. This goes all the way back. This is where you find it, back in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6. It's the first time that you find mention of this. And let me just take a look at that so you can see that that's where the quote now in Romans chapter 4 comes from. It says, he believed in the Lord, and he, that would be the Lord, reckoned it to him as righteousness. Well, that's the same idea. But what was reckoned to him? His believing in the Lord. His faith was reckoned to him. Now, it's not the only place just in the book of Romans that you can find this. It's got a lot about this in Galatians as well. Look at Galatians chapter 3 and verse 6. It's where the passage is quoted from Genesis. Same one that's used in Romans, that Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now, what is it that's accounted to Abraham? Again, I would say, well, it's his faith that's being credited or accounted here as right. How do you see something else? I don't know how that is. You've really got to work at it to put something else in there when it seems like that this is the thing that's obvious. It was accounted to him for righteousness, or credited, in Romans chapter 4 and verse 3. So we ask the question, well, what is it? Well, again, it's Abraham believed God. That's what was accounted to Abraham. And in other words, it was his faith. The faith was his own. It wasn't somebody else's faith that was credited to him. And the righteousness here, it was a credit for righteousness, that's his righteousness. Now, I understand there's lots of religious people that say, that, oh, well, we can't be righteous. And it's just impossible for us to be righteous. And see, that opens the door and that fits in with the whole life. Well, see, since we can't do it and it's just impossible. Not only do they teach the impossibility of apostasy, they also believe in the impossibility of righteousness. They don't say that, but that's what they believe. That means that's why the righteousness of Christ is so valued. Because we need that. And that's got to be transferred to us in order that we can have that kind of thing and then fit into the whole system. But the righteousness was his own. Have more to say on that in just a moment. But let's just think for a moment or two and examine a couple of things about Abraham's faith. And to do that, why don't you go over to James chapter 2. Now in James chapter 2, now let me hasten to point out, in the passages that Brother Brad read for us in Romans chapter 4, it talks about how Abraham had faith before he was ever circumcised. Before anything of the law, anything like that, he had faith. What's Paul's point in bringing that up? That faith can come about without the law. Well, we've got the gospel now. Well, the gospel can produce faith. You don't need the law. You don't need circumcision either. So you've got faith without law. Abraham's the example of that. And once again, that goes counter to what a lot of people have to say about it. We've got a law now. It would be the law of Christ. But still, Abraham was justified by faith, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. James chapter, 2. Let's start with verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? Whose faith? Abraham's faith. And then what does it say? Oh, well, look in verse 23. There's that same passage back in Genesis, in Romans, in Galatians. It's quoted again. Abraham believed God, it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now, the very people who see that over there in Romans 4 and in Galatians 3 and back there in Genesis chapter 15, they'll all tell you, well, now that faith Abraham had, it was without works. Our works are just a terrible thing. Boy, you get works in there and faith and grace and everything else just going out the window. Well, I don't know. I see here that his faith, Abraham, in offering his son, his faith together with those works, the faith was made perfect, complete. And what is that faith? Well, that's what he believed. And that faith then was accounted to him for righteousness. And what else does it say there? Well, he was called the friend of God. One of the things you learn in the New Testament is that a friend is someone who will do something for you. I think we know that in life, don't we? And furthermore, Jesus said, if you're his friend, well, you'll do whatever he commands you to do. So God commands Abraham, and in the matter with Isaac, and Abraham's doing it. And God realizes he's going to do what I tell him to do. He's my friend. He's got that kind of faith. His works have shown his faith. And it was accounted to him for righteousness. I think we know what that means, don't we? He had this faith, and Abraham had this faith before he offered Isaac. Offering Isaac, it were the works that proved, that were showing that faith. Well, yeah, that's right. And so his works demonstrated, I think, the depth and the truth of his faith. Look at James chapter 2, verse 18. Someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works. I'll show you my faith by my works. I think that's what Abraham was doing, wasn't it? He wasn't saying that, but that's what he was doing, and that's how it all came out. Well, what else? How about in verse 24? You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. As hard as you can try to have salvation by faith only, the scriptures don't allow it. As much as those who say that salvation is by faith only, and they go over here and they latch on to Abraham, and I know this is the truth because I had an exchange of several letters with a Baptist preacher, and he kept over and over and over again, all he wanted to talk about was salvation by faith only, and he ran to Abraham all of the time. And I would repeatedly tell him to deal then with that with James chapter 2. Interestingly, he always gave James chapter 2 the Passover. Why? Because, first of all, the idea of faith only is blown up. And second of all, using Abraham as an example of faith only without works, that gets all blown up. You can't do that. After a while, he's not going to answer anything, and our exchange just kind of dried up. But what about us now? With all of this, what about us? Don't you think about that for just a moment? What about us? Us with faith and righteousness. Well, I've got an idea that faith can be accounted or credited to us as well. For righteousness, when we would do things properly, do the right thing, the things that God would have us to do. And I say that because on the basis of several things I see. You know, Romans chapter 4 is actually, and chapter 5 is an explanation of why faith is necessary and how it works and the importance of it. And so on. And then when you get over to chapter 6. Chapter 6, you get to the nuts and bolts of obeying God. And especially right in the middle of chapter 6. Look at Romans chapter 6 and verse 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one's slaves whom you obey. Now just stop there. Who doesn't know that's not true? Whoever you choose to obey, you're servants to that one. The minute you start obeying them, you're their servant. Who doesn't know that? But then he goes on to point out the possibilities of this. And this would be, you become a slave of sin to death, or obedience, what's that word? Obedience to righteousness. Oh, you can't be righteous. There's nothing that you can do for righteousness. Well, this says that when you present yourselves slaves to obey, you're slaves to whom you obey, and obedience to righteousness, you can do that, you mean? You can make a choice? Yeah. Isn't that what the gospel's all about? I think that it is. I'll tell you what, I don't think there's a whole lot of problem, a lot of noise about the becoming a slave to disobedience. Everybody look at that now. Oh yeah, look at that right there. They made that choice. And when they decided to go in that direction, and they became slaves sin unto death, yes. And they'll go right along with that, and they'll talk about how bad that is, and one thing and another, all their responsibility, they're accountable for it, everything you can think of. They're right on board with it. But then you go the other way and talk about obeying things and becoming a slave to righteousness. And oh my goodness, oh no, no, none of that. We can't do anything for righteousness. Really? Well, it says something different. As a matter of fact, he goes on just a little bit and says, God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, you've obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you delivered. You see, they've made a change. They've chosen the right way. They've obeyed. What is that now? They've obeyed this. Is that that obedience to righteousness? Yes. Because in verse 18, having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. Also, righteousness is possible for the Christian. And that righteousness for the Christian, that's because you've obeyed. Is that like Abraham's faith was accounted to him for righteousness? So your faith and your obedience to faith, that's accounted for righteousness? Yeah, it would be the same thing. Anything about transferring in here? No, no. You've made a choice. This is the result. Sin unto death, obedience unto righteousness. And not only that, this is the one. I have a good friend of mine pointed this out to me one time. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 7. I think what John writes here is something that's important and something that ought to be focused on today. And I don't know what someone who's a Calvinist does with this passage. I don't know. I've got no idea. But it says, little children, let no one deceive you. Why would they be trying to deceive you? They're trying to get you to believe something that's not true. Is it related to this? I'd say it would be. What is it? He who practices righteousness is righteous just as he is righteous. How about that? He who practices righteousness is right. You make a choice. Slave to obey. The what? Obedience to righteousness. And that's what it's saying right here. You suppose that there were some that were trying to tell people, oh, you don't need to do that. You know what? That Bible, you don't need to pay much attention to it. You don't need to do this or that or the other. You know, I got an idea that if the righteousness of Christ was transferred over to me, and I had that, and it was out here like this bubble that I could be under, why would I ever have to worry about practicing righteousness? Why? What would that passage mean to me? It'd be a mystery to me. I don't understand that. But now if I'm responsible, and if I'm supposed to pursue righteousness, if it's me that's to be a slave to righteousness, well, this passage is very important along that line. And there's another one I'd like for you to consider, and that's in Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2 and verse 12. Now, before verse 12, he writes that the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. Now, personally, I think that this that's appeared to all men, I think that's referring to Jesus. There he is, full of grace and truth. That's appeared to all men, for all men. I think that's what it's referring to. But then it goes on to say in verse 12, teaching us that, denying ungodliness and worldly lust, you can make a choice to deny those things. I can make a choice to deny those things. We're not helpless out here in front of them. But then what else does he say? Well, we should live soberly. Now that's a word that doesn't mean, in our day and age, sober means not drunk. But originally the word sober meant somebody that was in their right mind. Maybe that's got a connection. A lot of times people that are drunk aren't in their right mind, are they? But we should live soberly. You know, we should have our sense about us. I always think about this in the older translations.
with the prodigal son, that it says when he got out there, he ran out of money, ran out of friends, ran out of everything. He got as low as he could be. You can just see him just dressed in just tatters of clothing out there in the hog, at where the hog pen's at, probably in it, looking at this out there and thinking how good those husks, those pigs are eating, would be. Think about how low he was. How did he get there? Yeah, he made a lot of bad choices. That's how he got there. He got there all on his own. And now here he is. If that's not rock bottom where he's at, I don't know what. There may be things worse, but that's just as low as he could get. And what does it say when you get to that point? It says in the older translation that he came to himself. I think that is such a great expression. Newer translations may have something like, or you may have it in your footnote, when he came to his right mind. Yeah. And then what happened when he came to himself? Then he started going in the right direction, didn't he? I'll return to my Father. And I'll say, I've sinned against you. I realize I just really blew it. And I'm not worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired servants. Just take me back as much as you can. I'm willing. Is that repentance on his part? Repentance, begging for mercy. You know the whole thing in there about the prodigal son is a lesson about mercy. The whole thing. You've got someone who just acts just as stupid as you can act. Looks for mercy and gets it. And it ends up with another person, the son, the other son, who won't show any mercy at all. It's all about mercy in there. But I look at this passage here, and I think about how we're supposed to live soberly. There are times, you know, we need to come to ourselves, come to our senses. But what else does it say? Well, we should not only just live soberly, we should live righteously and godly. Now, godly doesn't mean that we become gods, but it means that we become what God expects of us. Same as righteous, what God asks us to do. And so, what's it saying there? Well, it's saying that, you know, it's things that we can do. But we've got these religious friends that say, oh no, you can't do righteousness, never, not a chance of that. Abraham did it. A righteous man is righteous even as he does righteousness. 1 John chapter 3, verse 7. Christians are to live righteousness. And I remember Jesus telling in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, unless your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees. He didn't say that Jesus' righteousness had to exceed the righteousness. He says yours. Did he expect it? Does that mean we could do it? Or was it a carrot and stick thing that's always out there, we never can? We've got to get this idea out of our head. There are things expected of us, and we can do these kinds of things. Now, a couple other things, the lesson is yours. In Romans chapter 10, take your songbooks, turn the songs been selected. In Romans chapter 10 and verse 3, Paul is sorrowful for his fellow countrymen, the Jews. And he goes on to say, they've got this zeal for God. But he said, it's not the right kind of zeal. He says, they've gone about trying to establish their own righteousness. What does this tell us? Paul's saying, you can't do that. That's the wrong thing to do. Not their own righteousness. It can't be our own righteousness. We can't set up the standards for this. We've got to go with what God says our righteousness should be. And as God lays out the points of righteousness, Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, you know the passage. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. You know what goes on beyond that last word, God? It says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Now, how do I find out about His righteousness? What's that talking about there? It's talking about the righteousness that He delivers to us. Now, the reason I know this is because in the very part, first part of the book of Romans, and in chapter 16, which we know that the gospel is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. Now, the next verse is just as important as verse 16. Verse 17 says, for in it, there we go, we look for an antecedent. What's the it? Well, it's the gospel. For in it, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. If we want to know about the righteousness of God, seek it, have it, we go to the gospel. It will tell us what we need to do. Are we seeking that righteousness? Perhaps someone here today is thinking about this, initially speaking, to become a child of God. The opportunity would be yours today, at this time, to lay hold unto eternal life. If you've done that, fallen by the wayside, or your life isn't what it should be, you want to kind of do better, do more, do the right thing, to begin to live soberly and righteously and godly. If prayer needs to be made, correction, we'd be happy to assist you in that. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject to the gospel invitation, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.